morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. Thank you, Ms. Zeldin. Rosenthal, Monheit, Gross, and Goddess. On behalf of the appellees, I rise to introduce my co-counsel in counterclockwise order, Peter Carter from the Dorsey Whitney Law Firm in Minneapolis. He will be making arguments today on behalf of Steris. John Patterson, Pat Brumbaugh from the King & Spalding Law Firm in Atlanta, Georgia. He will be making arguments on behalf of First Islamic Investment Bank, Crescent, and Crescent Holdings. And Mr. Michael Smith, also from the King & Spalding Law Firm. He will not be presenting argument today. Thank you.
Good morning. Welcome to the court.
Thank you. Good morning, Justice Holland, Justice Berger, Justice Ridgely. My name is Rick Miller. I'm with the firm of Ferry, Joseph & Pierce, Wilmington. It's my pleasure to introduce the court to my co-counsel, Mr. Timothy Russell, Mr. Michael Wagner, both of the firm Spector, Gadden & Rosen in Philadelphia. Mr. Russell will be presenting argument on behalf of the appellant, Aero Global Capital Management.
Good morning. Welcome to the court.
Good morning.
May it please the court, thank you first for giving me the privilege of appearing before you. I'd like to focus, if I may, on what I see as the three principal issues in this case. First, we're there on this record. Genuine issues of fact as to whether Cirrus Industries modified or waived the requirement in the party's contract, the letter of intent, concerning the timing of Aero Global's payment of the final $3 million installment of the $15 million bridge financing. Second, were there genuine issues of material fact as to whether Aero Global repudiated some obligation, additional obligations, by suggesting that the final consummation of the party's transaction might be delayed by intervening circumstances. And finally, I would address very briefly the personal jurisdiction issue relating to First Islamic Investment Bank. I'll turn to the first issue. First, under the letter of intent, Aero Global was nominally bound to pay Cirrus $15 million in bridge loans immediately. It paid $12 million. It then suspended the payment of the balance because of the initiation of the Chancery Court proceeding. If Cirrus accepted that suspension, that is, if it formed the intention to permit the suspension and allow the transaction to go forward, then it remained bound by the no-talk, no-shop provisions of Section 4 of Letter of Intent. We know that it did talk and that it did, in fact, clandestinely negotiate a substitute deal with Crescent and CHCL, the other appellee, in the meantime. The gravamen of our claim is that that was a breach of the letter of intent. The central issue in this case and on this appeal is whether the trial court was correct in ruling on a Rule 56 motion that no reasonable juror could find from the record evidence that of Cirrus's words and of its intent that deferral of the timing requirement had been consented to, waived, or that it had been modified. Let me turn to a brief summary of the record facts from which we think a reasonable juror could have found an intention on Cirrus' part to waive or modify the timing provision. The most telling of the record facts, we think, is the fact that Cirrus owned CEO and President Alan Klapmeyer admitted before his board of directors on July 13 that notwithstanding the deferral of the payment of the $3 million, Cirrus remained bound by the no-talk, no-shop provisions. That is, that the failure of Aero Global to pay the $3 million immediately upon the signing of the letter of intent was of no importance to him in his view, and of course that was a predicate to the no-talk, no-shop provision remaining in force. He believed, and he stated to his board of directors, with only one director expressing any dissent at all from his view, the fact that the no-talk, no-shop provision remained in effect, and that therefore, in his view, the company had waived and accepted the deferral of the $3 million provision. I would point out that Mr. Klapmeyer was the only representative of Cirrus with the authority from the board to deal with Aero Global, to deal with the letter of intent at all. Second, and then 4 days later, the entire service board expressed what it referred to as its comfort, quote unquote, upon being advised that Aero Global had expressed the intention to pay the remaining $3 million, but not until the Chancery Court proceeding was concluded. Third, Cirrus, aware of what Mr. Klapmeyer's view was, that the no-talk, no-shop provision remained in effect because Cirrus had effectively waived the $3 million timing provision, not the requirement that it be paid, but the timing provision, agreed among themselves, again, I believe, on the 13th, the meeting on the 13th of July, to conceal their ongoing negotiations with Crescent because they understood that they were not permitted by the no-talk, no-shop provision to conduct those negotiations, and for a period of time until the information leaked out, those provisions were concealed. Those discussions, excuse me, were concealed. Next, Cirrus represented to the Chancery Court that not that there had been a breach of the timing provision with respect to the $3 million, but the mere suspension of the payment, that the bridge loan had, the transaction had, quote-unquote, been consummated between Cirrus and Aero Global, that the payment of the additional $3 million would be forthcoming and would be accepted by Cirrus. Cirrus then, before the Chancery Court, sat by in apparent agreement as Aero Global's counsel, myself, represented explicitly to the Chancery Court that there had been a, quote, understanding or, quote, accommodation between the two parties regarding the deferral of the $3 million payment. Next, despite the delay in the $3 million payment, Cirrus accepted the initial $12 million, set to work with Aero Global and its transactional lawyers to prepare to consummate the transaction, and not once until this clandestinely negotiated deal with Crescent had been put together did Cirrus proclaim a breach, purport to rescind or to attempt to terminate the letter of intent, and not once during that entire period of time did it ever approach Aero Global and make a demand with a definite drop-dead deadline for the final payment of the $3 million. We submit that was not inaction on Cirrus's part, but in the total circumstances of this case, that was an affirmative, or could be taken as an implicit affirmative representation that the deferral of the $3 million payment was acceptable to it. Next, almost 3 weeks after the letter of intent had been executed, and the $3 million had not been paid, quote-unquote, immediately, the Cirrus board on July 6th nonetheless voted unanimously again to reconfirm its transaction with Aero Global under the letter of intent. Finally, Cirrus sought and obtained Aero Global's approval late in the day, toward the end of July, the week ending August 2nd, in fact. It sought and obtained Aero Global's approval to use $5 million of the original $12 million, which $5 had been set aside to pay the so-called break fee due to Crescent under their original transactions agreement. It sought and obtained Aero Global's